Hey, it's Jeff and Jeremy from the Ultra Running Guys. And if you're here, you probably already know that we started this podcast to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey.
But what you may not know is that in addition to this podcast, we also host two live races in the Wilmington, North Carolina area that are designed to do the same.
Yep, the first is the Hydra, which takes place on April 20th and has a 50K individual, a 50K relay, and a half marathon option. Whatever option you choose, we promise that slaying the Hydra will be unlike any race that you've ever experienced.
And the second is the Final Countdown, which takes place on September 14th. And whether you've never run before or you're a hardcore ultra veteran, this race is designed to help you find your limits. And we will be there with you to help celebrate.
All right, so mark your calendars, share with your friends, and visit us at our website, theultrarunningguys.com, or check out the links in the show notes for more info.
And with that, enjoy the episode, and remember, when in doubt, just show up. And welcome back to the Ultra Running Guys. You got Jeremy Reynolds and Jeff Winchester of the Ultra Running Guys. And the reason that we're here is to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey. And so just about 3 years ago, we started a podcast and we have talked to a bunch of incredible runners. And that's been a lot of fun. However, a big part of taking your next step is figuring out what races make sense for you, right? So just a little while back, we started this race spotlight series and it's been so fun. And rather than us just tell you about these races, we figured who better to learn from than the race directors themselves. And I am really excited about tonight's race because one, it's tough. And two, we've had a couple guests that have really just kind of torn apart the course and just had some great experiences. But tell us what we're up against.
Yeah, and it's also cool because we have two race directors tonight to talk about. One of the things, though, that I find fascinating about a lot of races that we look at when we spotlight races, we do some reviews of websites and course descriptions, and we are also race directors as well. And so there's a lot of times that we will try to do everything we can to convince runners to take their next step, right, that they should join us for this race. Here's why we think they can do it. But when you read about this race, which is the Cruel Jewel 100, their website does a lot of a different approach. It kind of gives you all the reasons why this is going to be pure carnage and pure challenging for you, right? It is a race that is going to be difficult. And it's intended to kind of give you that forewarning up front. And I think that's what I really find valuable about the website and about the way the race is organized and stuff. And so just a little bit of background. The Cruel Jewel is actually 104 miles now and takes place deep in the Chattahoochee National Forest in the northern Georgia mountains, which is, so it's not too far from you and I because we're in North Carolina. And the race has 33,000 feet of gain and loss. And so at 104 miles, you're looking at a little over 300 feet of elevation per mile. That's a ton of gain in a mile. It is going to be what we would say is relentless. You do have a 48-hour overall cutoff for the race, which also, when you think in terms of 100, most of them have a 30 to 32-hour cutoff or 36 at the most. 48 hours gives you heads up, right? It's not going to be a cakewalk. And so the other thing to know is that there is a total race time, there is a total race time like there is no other. I'm just stumbling because my notes are all over the place. I apologize. So let me just skip all over that and just tell you, but let's get into the Cruel Jewel with our race directors that are joining us today. And that is Sarah Snyder and Sean Langford. Sean and Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Team Dumbass.
Team Dumbass.
And Sean Lawford, correct?
That's correct.
Say Langford?
Yep.
We're good. Because I know a Langford. I'm sorry, Sean Lawford.
All right. So I think actually his info, he ran Hostility, 24 Hours of Hostility at the Hiker Hostel, which was owned by Josh and Lee, who started Dumbass Events. And they had him in as like a race day registration. And I think his alter sign up actually had him listed as Langford.
It might have been.
So
and that's why we did so much research. We knew it was Sean Langford.
On the rabbit hole.
Yeah, there you go. And that's Levi in the background.
Yeah, this is Levi. This is my Velcro dog here.
Well, and so some people are going to say, okay, so the company, which I think is awesome, Dumbass Events, right? But it does stand for something. Tell everybody where that name came from.
The Lanega Ultra Marathon Association.
So there is a method to the madness, but it's way more fun just to say dumbass.
And it is.
Oh, what happened?
All right.
And the slogan is poor decisions make for better stories.
And
oh, I like that.
The great thing about ultras are the experiences that come with them, right? You're going to find all different kinds of cultures. And I think it starts to become pretty clear from the name, from, you know, the slogan that you are a fun bunch. And we'll talk about the race itself, because obviously 104 miles at 33,000 feet probably isn't going to all be fun, but if you're around a lot of fun people, I'm sure it makes a difference. So here's the deal. We are going to talk about Cruel Jewel 100. We've already talked. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard. If you're listening right now, we're going to get into some of the tactical stuff, right? What should you know? How do you prepare for this type of race to figure out if it's right for you? But we want to know from you guys, before we jump into that, what is your favorite thing about the Cruel Jewel 100?
It's such a beautiful course without being a scenic course, if that makes sense. So it's not like the races out west where you're above tree line and you can just see for miles or anything. You're kind of in this green tunnel, but it's beautiful in its own right. There's literally one spot on the entire course where there's any view of a mountain, and it is on Coosa. But depending on the time of day that you actually hit it, determines whether you get to see anything there or not. And this is actually Coosa Jolene, her grandparents. This dog was named after that mountain. She's 92 pounds of terror, just like the mountain itself is. So that's probably the thing that I like about it, is that it's beautiful in its own right. And it's a beautiful in a different way than the races out west are. And Sean can probably speak a little bit more to that, because he's actually run the 100. I've only run the 50. I was a repeat offender and ran it twice, but Sean has actually run and finished the 100.
So Sean, what's your personal favorite?
I'd have to say that as far as the community is probably going to always be my favorite, just because it's such a fun, it's a great community. It really is. The ultra community was wonderful. As far as like, all of the communities that I've ever been a part of, the ultra pretty much takes the cake in that sense. And CJ's really a tough race for a lot of people. And I think that the support that you see, whether it be like on the trail or from the runners and the crews and the volunteers, especially, right? I mean, these guys are out there for 48 hours, if not a little bit longer. So I see that the course is pretty. When I was still running, it was my favorite 50 miler, even though I'm biased now. Before they brought us into the company, we ran all of their races, or all of our races now. And the course is absolutely stunning. The 50 is really pretty. The 100 just isn't as pretty.
I love it. All right. So give us though a little bit of background. The race has been around for a while now. Give us some of the history on it, how long it's been around, and then what is it that you think keeps people coming back?
So the short of it is an ultra runner here in the South was running in the South, went out west, ran a few races out west. We didn't have anything at that time, 10 years ago, that was as like the West is always going to be the big races, right? Like it gets a lot of the hype, a lot of the accolades and all of that. He went out there, ran with a lot of the runners out there and said, you know, we need something like this back home. And he came back and created the course, Cruel Jewel. And CJ's, lots of climbing, lots of, East Coast races or more punches in the teeth, right? I mean, there, it's not a 5 mile climb. It's more of lots of little climbs that just beat you down.
And technical,
it's rocky, it's straight up and down. It's in May, which can be extremely hot and extremely cold. So you go through a few of those changes. But anyway, so Willie started it, brought Josh and Lee on, for the first 2 years, and then passed it along to Josh and Lee. They held it up for the next 2 to 3 years. Then they brought us in, and
here we are.
Yeah.
And so how long has it been around now? So what year are we on?
This will be 11.
Okay.
Yeah. Perfect. 2023 was the 10th year anniversary for the 100.
That's fantastic.
Congratulations. So as runners are trying to figure out if they should run this race, right? If they feel like they've got some training in them and everything, why do you think that runners should actually choose to run the Cruel Jewel?
So I think we are biased because we do think that it's one of the prettiest courses. It is incredibly challenging, but the one thing that we make sure is that it's manageable to finish even for like a mid pack, back of the pack runner. As long as you keep moving, you can power hike this thing. You just can't stop. There's no room for error in that sense with, you know, not having the luxury of trailside naps and things of that nature. But the 48 hour cutoff for the 100 is a power hike if you can continuously move forward and not stop.
I like that.
Non-stop power hike. That's she's look
right.
48 hours of not known stopping.
It's tough. I mean, it's tough. I think we're one of the tougher on the East Coast. Not that there are a lot of 100 miles on the East Coast of this nature, but as far as like the tough 100 milers, I think we're one of the tougher 100 milers on the East Coast. As far as why runners should come run it, I think mostly it's for the challenge, right? It's for the challenge. It's for the community. Georgia's pretty that time of year. I mean, but I don't think you get to see a lot of that, especially when you're running the 100. It gets miserable, right? It's a beatdown. I think it's a very challenging race. We try and make it better every year, try and get the support systems in place that people have everything they need to finish and give them the best chance that they can to finish, which is I guess the biggest part of our goal is to make sure that they have everything they can so that they can actually finish.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about it so much. And so, you know, a big part of our audience, as they develop, you know, I think kind of mid to back of the pack, and sometimes they can be really intimidating, right? Especially when you start looking at time cutoffs and stuff. And if you want to challenge yourself, but you're worried about, can I stay ahead of the time cutoffs? When you open it up the way that you guys have done, it kind of gives them the freedom to go, okay, let's see how tough I am, right? Hopefully it won't be the time, it'll be the, you know, can I go tackle this thing, and it removes that obstacle. And I really like that.
Make no mistake, I don't mean to interrupt, but you've seen the times that the fast guys finish this race then,
right?
Like, so we've only had, is Canyon the only one that broke 24?
No, he broke it. And then the next year, two people did, but neither of them.
So in 10 years, we've only had three people break 24 hours at this course. And that includes, lots of,
yeah,
we've had elites years. Come out. We've had pros come out. And it's a tough course. So for us to put a 32 hour, we have so many people that finish between 36 and 48 hours. Between 40 and 48 hours. How many people finish in the last 2 hours of this race? It is, right. So that time cutoff is not only there to give people the opportunity to finish, but it's because it's necessary. Otherwise, we'd have half the race wouldn't finish.
Right.
We're already finish our race, anyways. So. Right.
It's tough. Yeah.
And so you mentioned Canyon. So we had Canyon Woodward on the show, and Western North Carolina guy. So grew up in the mountains, right? That's kind of his thing, and came out and obviously as a record holder for you guys, did his thing. We also had Tara Dower. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things too, and I watched her like race report of this and her video, I mean, that's what she does, right? She is a mountain runner, through hiker type. And she was like, yeah, this is tough. Right. So if you're listening, I think the challenge is going to appeal, but also preparation is going to be key, because it's not something I would imagine that you just, let's show up unprepared and see what happens. Right.
Yeah, you definitely can't come into this race unprepared. You just can't. It's never going to end well.
So let's talk about it though, then, from that direction. If a runner is feeling prepared and they feel like they've done a lot of training to prepare for the power hiking, if you will, or the climbing that would be required of them, what do you think it is that they would underestimate about the course that will still catch them by surprise?
I think I think there's lots of things. The biggest thing that we see are people just aren't prepared for it, because maybe they're coming from out west and they're not used to the technical. I mean, look, there's lots of technical hard stuff out west, but they're just, it's a lot of people don't expect this Georgia race to be what it is, right? They hear it's tough, they hear it's technical, but until you get into mile 40, 50, 60, it's really hard to see just how technical and tough some of these trails are, especially with the rain we've had the past couple of years, you know, and some of the trails getting washed out or, but it's just, it's little mountains. The profile is, I'm going to do it that way, but the profile is just little climb after little climb. And then the downhills start to beat you up too, because you're either going, I think once you get into the back half of this now, it used to be on the front half, but it literally is 20 to 30 miles of just up and down, up and down, up and down, and maybe a little bit more, but of straight up, straight down, straight up, straight down. And the trails are technical. So it's just, it becomes relentless.
So the course change that we had to do took it from having your Duncan Ridge Trail, which is where the majority of the elevation is, being your first 30 miles and then 20 miles of runnable mountain running, and then hitting the DRT on the way back. Now you have these easier miles until you hit, basically you get over Brawley Mountain, and then once you hit Will Scott and then get up to climb Skeena, Rhodes Mountain, that whole area, you're in climbing for almost 40 miles. So it stacked all the majority of the elevation right smack in the middle. And I kind of thought that runners would appreciate that and think like, okay, well, I'm not doing it on fresh legs and then on completely trash legs. I'm kind of getting it all out of the way with like moderately destroyed legs. But a lot of people have said that it's actually harder the way it is now with all of that elevation kind of like crammed in the middle.
Yeah, I would imagine that would wear on you. So on that point though, from your guys' experience, what can somebody do to prepare, knowing that, like, if you were to tell them, hey, you're coming to my race, this is what I suggest.
If you're a local runner, get on the Duncan Ridge Trail and spend as much time on it as you possibly can. And from personal experience in training for 100 miler is like, don't plan for every run, for every training day to be a run, but plan on some of those training days being hiking and aggressive hiking. And, you know, what my friend Angie calls it, hiking with a purpose. Like, you need to be out there moving, but you definitely need to be training your body to hike. You need to be able to hike and be, have your body prepared for those hikes versus thinking that you're going to be able to go out and run all of it. Mm-hmm.
So just for the sake of definitions and for people listening, when you say technical trails, there, you know, we're obviously in Eastern North Carolina. We sometimes get into trails on the western side of the state. So when you say technical trails, do you mean Rudy or do you mean bouldering?
Both.
It's rocky and Rudy.
We're the southern terminus of the Appalachian Trail. So if you've ever been on the AT in the southeast, it's very typical of just that southeast technical trails, roots, rocks, lots of ups, lots of downs. It's just the, we've had a couple of reroutes over the time to make it a little bit easier. The Forest Service is making some of the trails a little bit easier for hikers that go into it. But, other than that, it's pretty typical of the Southeast, the AT basically.
Okay.
So, and maybe you already talked about it with that 40 miles in the middle, but, you guys made the switch not too long ago, but what would you say would be kind of the highest risk for DNF? Is there a spot on the course where you see the most drops that if I'm like going to run this race, I want to be like, okay, prepare?
Not so much. I think that just like it makes it sound like it's almost unmanageable. It's not. It's just a tough race, right? Like as far as hundreds go, it's tough. There's lots of elevation. There's a little bit of technical trail. So it's tougher for it's not as easy as going to Florida and qualifying for some of the races that they have down there, or even some of the races that we have up here. If you're going to do your first 100, I'd say you might want to do something else first before you come out and tackle this, but that's to be said of races all over the country, right?
I think weather plays a lot too in where we see high drop rates at different aid stations. Sean can speak to Fish Gap during a downpour in 2017. No,
we had one of the hurricanes brushed by Georgia that year, and it made it pretty brutal. It took me 15 hours to go, 20 miles? And you couldn't see at one point for about 8 hours. You couldn't see 5 feet in front of you because it was pouring. The rain was pouring. It was rivers. I showed up to one of the aid stations and people were in, ankle deep to calf deep water with it. They had this tent over a fire pit, basically. And the fire was like, the tent was over the fire pit. They're all huddled around because you can't get out of that particular aid station. It's a no drop just because there's no way to get people in or out of it.
It's an hour drive one way just to get to that particular aid station from civilization, basically.
But to your question, there's so many different things going on in every 100 mile, right? So it just really depends. We don't see any particular spot on the race that people struggle with more than others because there is so much climbing, right? Like, and that's just it. That's the poor decisions make for better stories because all of our races are tough. The July 4th race we put on is July 4th weekend, Camp Merrill. It's on a flat track with, 9 degrees of elevation, I think, or something.
7 feet.
7 feet of elevation around the whole track, but it's July 4th weekend. The track radiates heat, right? But
Full sun exposure.
Cruel Jewel's tough. It's technical. It's 33,000 feet of elevation. I think people kind of know what they're getting into.
I think another thing that we are really fortunate about that gets runners through some aid stations where they're in really tough spots are the phenomenal volunteers that we have running some of these aid stations. You come into Will Scott Gap and you have Keith Gates, who literally they got a picture of him last year. He's wearing his CJ belt buckle and he's pointing to it and showing someone where on the elevation profile on the course, on the buckle they are at that point. Keith has rallied people back from, the brink of despair, I think. We are really fortunate to have the people that captain some of these aid stations. And most of them, if not all of them, have run either CJ or some other race of ours or just a Southeast race. And so they know what these people are going through and the pain that they're feeling. And they're just really amazing people that can talk people into continuing, short of compound fractures, let's say.
That's awesome. And I know we've been obviously hammering the idea about it being a tough race and it is manageable, like you said, and you've given a very generous cutoff. And the other thing to point out, it's not a bad thing to say it's a tough race because it's also a qualifier for Western States and I believe Hard Rock as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. But that's why we ran it, right? Like we seek out these races that are lots of runners and just endurance athletes seek out challenges. And that's that was it. Okay, well, this is one of the tougher in Georgia. We're going to run this. And there were a couple other that I seek out, just like people seek out the big races out west or the other big races on the East Coast. And that's just the challenge.
I think it's an attractive race for a lot of those that look for that challenge, that want to push themselves to that point. And so it's good to paint that picture for them because that's what they're looking for. And I think it's great. Tell us about the aid stations though, in general, but roughly what's the distance between them? You already said they're pretty inaccessible in general from civilization, but for runners themselves, as they're going from one aid station to the next, what are you looking at from a distance standpoint and even what they can expect at them?
Shortest distance, I should say, is around 3.5 miles. And then I want to say the longest is Fish to Skeena. No, Fire Pit to Fish. It's like 7.4, 7.3 miles. And it's a hard stretch. Like that's part of the Duncan Ridge. Like you're in the thick of it there. So they're no more than like that 7.5 miles or so. And then closest is like around that 3.5. We've got a pretty sweet setup for our aid stations. We've got 10 foot by 20 foot tents. We have heaters, generators, lights, camp stoves. I'm plant-based, so it's really important for me for food options to be there for, I call myself the obnoxious vegan anytime I go somewhere. So I try to make sure that we accommodate even a little bit to those people to have plant-based options. We do a really amazing tomato soup that is coconut milk and vegan butter-based, so it's good for anyone. We do sweet potato black bean burritos, also vegan. Sean's the chef in the house, so he does a lot of cooking.
There's a laundry list of different foods depending on which aid stations you go to. We try and have more whole foods than just the sugar table. Because it's such a long race, it's really hard, or I think a lot of people struggle with the constant like sugar. Right. So we try and have as many whole foods as we can. And I think the ultra world is turning into, you know, more whole foods, more cooked foods, more things of that. So we've put bigger cook stoves at most of the aid stations. Each aid station typically has some sort of theme, whether or not, hot dogs have become this wild thing that I never thought would be a big thing at Ultras, but it's just hamburgers. We have one aid station that can't keep hamburgers in because just where it is, people want a meal, right? Because you're out there, a lot of races have that 32-hour cutoff, and a lot of people can go that. But once you get in between 32 and 48, we realize that they want an actual like meal, right? Like, I'm ready to have lunch, or I'm ready to have dinner, or I'm ready to sit down and like eat a whole meal, rather than like those front runners that are living off of whatever they live off like bells and tailwind or whatever they're taking. But for us mere mortals, it's so important, because you have to sit down at some point through the day and a half to 2 days that you're out there and actually eat something, right?
Right.
So we've tried to do, and again, the volunteers, it kind of organically grows, right? This one aid station literally brought their own hamburgers 1 year, so now we give them a big grill and, you know, as much hamburger as we can stuff into a cooler. And they do that. There's a couple other aid stations that do their own thing. But that's just the important, is to have enough food for every aid station, to have enough water for every aid station, to have some warmth, to have some shelter, and just provide, you know, the best experience for them that we can. And ultimately, what the volunteers want, we pretty much try and stack at the aid stations. Mm-hmm. Because again, like Sarah said, they're just the core of the race, right? Like, so, and it's been nice to watch that organically grow. So each aid station kind of takes on its own little, I guess, environment, so to speak.
And volunteers can, I've never seen them break a race. I was going to say make or break a race, but that's not really true. I mean, but volunteers can be the heart, right? They really can make a difference for a runner. So to hear you guys talk about them like that is so cool. And if you're listening, one of the things, as I listen to you guys talk, I'm like, okay, 7 miles may not sound far, but I'm sure when there's a lot of hiking and walking and different things, the time could still be quite a stretch. And the other thing I would think is if you're a runner that's not used to or has not practiced eating a lot of whole foods on the move, I would think that this is the type of race where you want to come in having tested your stomach for that. Because to your point, you're going to be out there quite a while. So I think those are good tips.
You're going to be going through night twice too, because the race starts at noon on a Friday.
Oh, yeah.
And so it goes through darkness for most runners twice. And so they're going to be tired and they're going to be hungry. And those are things that you'd want to practice, eating real food and being up late.
Right. Going through night. And let me ask this, because there are some people, right, that really enjoy having a crew with them. But if somebody's looking at this, I would imagine the crew access is going to be difficult, but what if anything does crew access look like, and what should somebody know if they're trying to pitch a vacation to Georgia for a 100-mile race to their wife, you know?
Oh, runcations.
Runcation,
I think is
there. The aid stations that do have crew access are nowhere near as remote as Fish Gap is. Two of them, WillScot and Skeena, are right off of paved roads. It's where the trail actually crosses like a paved county road. The one issue that we run into at both of those spots is just limited parking. You know, they're small trailhead parking, so vehicles have been towed because they're not all the way off on the side of the road, off of the white line. And that's difficult, because if you're in a car, some of those ditches are a little intimidating to, you know, park a Prius in versus someone rolling in with, you know, like a pickup truck or some kind of 4x4. But the crew access aid stations, none of them require like a high clearance vehicle or four-wheel drive. Like they're all accessible in just like pretty much any vehicle. It's just a matter of the strategery that goes into parking them and finding a place to get off of the road and to not end up getting towed by county police. Patrol the areas pretty heavily those weekends. There's a one stretch of road that we kind of dub as like the Fast and Furious training grounds because people just drive crazy. So the cops are out there a little bit more, but they're policing crew access people as much as they're policing the locals just terrorizing the county roads. So, and then the only other one that is, it's still not rough to get to, Stanley Gap is a crew access aid station on the back half of the race. It's not on the way out. And that's just a Forest Service road getting up to a trailhead. But again, it's just tight parking, not a ton of room. So that's really like our biggest issue that we have run into this year, especially with the course change and just having everything be on the opposite end and not having Vogtle State Park as that landing place with all of the parking that the state park has been just finding room for cars and people at the start line and then at the crew access aid stations.
But there's no, so we have three crew accessible aid stations.
And so how many times is it because out and back see up to six potential essentially?
Yep. Okay. So sometimes they get a little busy is all Sarah's getting at, right? Yeah. So sometimes they get a little busy, but that's not a problem because we've created enough room. The aid station volunteers help with that. We just have to make sure that people kind of time it for their runners rather than show up, right? Like, so if you know your runner's not going to be up front, like give them a little bit of space to get to the aid station so we don't have, you know, 100 cars showing up to the first aid station.
A 20-minute drive to right. From one aid station to the next when your runner's not going to be there for 6 hours. Like, don't go straight to that next aid station. Like, allow that travel time. And that's, we put a pace calculator out that we shared through social media. And I think we may have linked it on the website too. But it has it's a Google sheet and it has the formulas built in that you plug in the mileage that your runner is going from the aid station where you just saw them to the next aid station, their anticipated pace and the time of day that you last saw them. And it gives you an anticipated arrival time to the next aid station. So we hope that people use that because, I mean, it's the easiest way to kind of take out the guesswork.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like I know that as a runner, and I'm trying to figure out what my crew is going to do and where they're going to go and how it's going to be to make sure they're there. You know, if on first pass, I'm thinking it's going to be challenging to find a parking spot. It's going to feel kind of concerning. But to hear what you're saying and how you're setting up this to be to solve the logistical issue is really helpful for a crew and a runner to be prepared to say, this is the best way of getting, you know, being at the place at the right time so that you can support me, also not impact other runners to have a good experience for me and a good experience for them. And so I think it's fantastic that you're doing that. And I think it's why having this type of conversation with you is really important, I think, for those who take the time to listen to this and understand this is the best way to experience the Cruel Jewel as a participant for my crew, what they can expect and how we can navigate this course in a way that makes the most sense for everybody involved. And I appreciate you kind of going into that. And even the fact that you have a calculator available, they should plug in is a huge value add.
Especially because you can download it to use for offline use because there's not a lot of cell signal in a lot of the areas out there. So you can download it and have it. And whenever they come through or if you're, you know, guesstimating between those check-ins, because we do have what we loosely refer to as live tracking because you're still talking about cell signal in the National Forest. So some of those timing mats don't quite update, but if you're, you know, using that, but you're in an area without cell signal, if you have that Google Sheet downloaded, then you can still use that to track even in between. So
two things I love about, we just actually had a great episode with Sandra Bullock Smith, who wrote a book literally about crewing, right? She's Mike Smith's wife. He's run over 200 100s. But the two things in the book, and I can't remember if we talked about this specifically, we talked about the pace chart for sure. Right. So you're handing that over because that was a big topic. But the second part in the book, she talks specifically about, hey, as a crew, understand where there may be limitations. Mm-hmm. Right. does it make sense to just go to the next aid station, or does it make sense to try to time it based off of the race? And so right. you providing that information, hopefully people are listening. I was like, oh, that's exactly the types of things she was talking about. And this sounds like the perfect application. All right. So let's talk about the registration. Obviously we've said, hey, it's tough. It's probably not come try out, you know, your very first 100 just willy-nilly. So I know you guys have qualifications. Talk to somebody if they're listening. What is the qualification? What does that look like? And then what do they need to know about registration, if there's any other things to consider?
So the main qualifiers for the 100 is to have runner finish CJ50. And then Georgia Death Race has been listed on the website as well, just because it's a lot of similar trail and or any other 100 miler. And we do take into consideration, people will approach us. A lot of times it's people who are either like Army Rangers or Special Forces. We've had Navy SEALs who have reached out and said, you know, like, I haven't run a 100 miler, but, you know, kind of like, here's my running resume, so to speak. And we'll look at that. And if it seems like they have done enough suffering in whatever capacity that is, whether in their personal or professional experiences, then we'll give them the green light and to have them go ahead and register. But truly, I think having run a mountain race, especially CJ50, gives you a good glimpse into what you're doing. Because if you go out and run CJ50 and you feel good enough at the finish to turn around and run back to your car, then CJ100, then go for it, sign up for it.
We're not terribly strict is the short of it. I think on the website it says we require a 100 mile finish to run it, but we're not terribly strict in that, because there are lots of tough 100K races all over the United States and overseas. We're starting to get some overseas runners as well. So we just want to make sure somebody's prepared and they've run a mountain race before is the short of it.
Yeah, it sounds like the big takeaway. Be prepared. And then if you're listening and maybe you have a different qualification, it sounds like reach out and have the discussion.
Yep.
So great.
That's all my questions, because I was going to go there too. But no, so last thing really for both of you then, I guess, is what does it mean for runners to choose to run your race?
What does it mean to you guys?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, man. This is, if you caught me like in even just like a remotely more tired state than I currently am, I would probably cry. I love being at the finish line. I hug every single runner who crosses that finish line. I don't care how bad they smell. I don't care how long they've been awake. I don't care if, can we swear?
We've already said dumbass.
No.
I don't care if someone shit their pants. Like, I am there to hand them this belt buckle that doubles as a weapon, doubles as a dinner plate, you know, may get you hung up in security on your flight back to your hometown, home state, whatever. It's to see the look on people's faces when they cross that finish line, having just accomplished what they have accomplished. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it, because it is just the most amazing thing to be able to witness. And it is truly an honor and a privilege. And it is something that, as exhausting as it is in all of the prep work that putting this race on requires, because it is months of logistics planning on, you know, computer spreadsheet, Forest Service permits and all that kind of stuff. And it's a week full of logistics with U-Haul trailers and 100-gallon water tanks and all of that, and sorting bins and everything else. It is so worth it to get to see those faces when they cross that finish line, and right down to the last runner. I ugly cried so bad when our DFL runner came in this year, because we were able to hand him, a bowling pin, a Crown brand bowling pin that we have had, that was given to us from Josh and Lee and from Willie from like the very first year. This bowling pin has been a piece of the race from its inception. And on the 10th year anniversary, that bowling pin is what we gave DFL on this beautiful holder that Sean made. He's a woodworker. And so he made this beautiful holder for this bowling pin to sit on. And a piece of my soul left me when I handed when we handed that to him. But to be able to have that amazing piece of that race be given to the person who was out there the longest and probably suffered the most was pretty special.
It really pours out from you. I mean, like, so, I mean, community is everything to us. It's why we do this, right? Is because of the amazing people we met, the experiences, the connections, watching other people connect with each other. And obviously that is at the heart of why you do what you do. And Sean, before this, I mean, you were talking about just really the grassroots nature of what you guys do, how important it is to you, you know, just to the kind of community that you have. And it really comes across. It's super cool.
Good.
I think that's into it.
Yeah. I think it's important. I mean, because I think for as runners and race directors and just endurance athletes and human beings, right? Like the community in the ultra world is pretty special because there's very little everybody's bound together by this suffering that you're out there doing whatever it is you're running from or to or trying to achieve or through these events. It's different than any other of the other athletic communities or other communities that we have that I've ever experienced. And it's pretty wonderful.
So good. I was just to say it's so good. So our motto is just show up. And obviously for this race, you want to show up prepared, I would say, put the caveat, right? Show up prepared. But if you're listening, I really hope that you got value from this. Like I said, we would love to have you plug in to the other show where we talk with runners, we talk through all these kinds of things, but these race spotlights just have been so much fun. And this is no exception. And we just appreciate your guys' time so much, what you do for the community. And I need to get my butt out to Georgia. Sounds like
cruel.
Yes.
Jewel.
Yeah.
It's for you.
The cruel jewel. And I mean, you know, I want to be part of the dumbass family. Don't say anything. I knew that was coming.
but happy guys.
Sarah and Sean, just thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
All right. And to everybody else, thank you so much. We appreciate everything about you. We will talk soon.
Got it. Thanks so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the content. If you haven't already, don't forget to check out our full lineup of podcast episodes that are designed to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey.
So be sure to check the links below and you can visit our website at theultrarunningguys.com or download your episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, when in doubt, just show up.
See ya. All right, listen, thank you so much. We recognize the fact that you are probably just hanging on just for a couple more minutes as you're finishing up your run. But really, we do want to give you a huge thank you for the constant support that you've shown us. We hear you and we feel you. And the best way for us to continue to grow is for you to share us with your friends. Tell them what you put in your ears when you're out there on a long run. Hit the like button, leave us a comment, leave a review, and give us some direct feedback on what you like about the show and also what you don't like. We're here to improve and do it for you.
And it really means the world. And listen, if you would like to support financially, you can connect with us on Patreon at patreon.com/theultrarunningguys, or you can use the support link in the show notes. Any and all support goes directly back into growing the show and helping us get better at what we love to do, which is to serve all of you. And with that, finish up that run, get cleaned up, and just show up.
Clean.
Clean.